All right, welcome back, everybody, to the Quill and Query podcast. This is season 2, episode 1. If you're watching us on TikTok, you probably noticed a little bit of a format change. We'll get into that in a few minutes. But my name is Brandon Hall, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Ash. Ash, how are you doing today? Me too. Super excited about our new software here. Yeah, we have a fun episode for season 2 to kick things off. We're going to talk about a bunch of different topics. We got writing pace and how it affects the quality of your writing. We're going to talk a little bit about character deaths and balancing multiple point of view characters and much more, like always. So hope you'll stick around. And if you have any topic suggestions for us for next week or anything like that, please be sure to share those in the chat. But before we get into all that, we'd like to tell you guys a little bit about what we're currently reading. So Ash, give us a breakdown of what you've been reading the past couple weeks.
Past couple weeks, I have been working through The West Passage by, I'm going to butcher his last name because I think it is Eastern European, but it's Jared Pachacik. Anyway, okay. It's an advanced reader's copy that I got, and I'm really liking it. It's like if Labyrinth meets Redwall. So it's been a good time so far.
Interesting.
What are you reading?
Well, I have it right here. I wanted to show it off. I'm taking a break from my normal cycle of books to read Dante's Inferno. It's probably going to be obscured by the green screen here, but I have a really cool illustrated edition here.
Oh.
And the reason I'm actually reading it is probably not what you're expecting. This book of all games of all books has a video game adaptation that I've been playing, and it's a lot of fun, and it has a bunch of lines from the book, so that made me want to take it off my shelf and actually give it a read, because it's been sitting there looking pretty for the past few months but has not been opened yet. So
is this your first foray into Dante, aside from the video game, like the actual source material?
Like my first time really diving into like the book. You know, I've heard of it and I've seen stuff from it, but I've never opened the book myself. So
okay, all right,
but I do love my classics, so I think I'll enjoy this one.
It's very good. As like a, you know, childhood Catholic myself, it was really interesting to me to read, only because like it's just such very vivid descriptions of torture and anguish, and you know, you're young and you're like, this sounds crazy but also terrifying. So
yeah,
I'm interested to hear your thoughts when you are finished with it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem terribly long, so I'm sure it won't take me as long as the other books, but we'll see. I'm a bit of a slow reader, as I think everyone who watches us knows. Well, that's what we're reading, but I touched on it a little bit. We have some podcast updates for you guys. If you are listening on RSS, Spotify, Amazon Music, pretty much anywhere, you'll notice that this is marked as season 2. That is because it's kind of a new beginning for Quill and Query. We have switched from TikTok Live Studio over to Riverside, which is a platform designed for podcasting. And it has a lot of really cool features that are going to help us achieve our goals surrounding things like quality, the ability to bring on guests, and reach more platforms like YouTube and stuff like that. So bear with us if there's any technical difficulties along the way. I did try to calibrate beforehand as much as possible, but some of this is just learning as you go. So please point it out if there's any audio or visual bugs or anything. And so we'll get those sorted out. But we hope you guys like the new format and the new software. In addition to that, Ash has been doing a great job leading our social media presence over on Instagram. If you have not followed it yet, it is, let me make sure I get the handle correct. It is at Quill and Query Podcast, and TikTok and YouTube will be coming soon. But if you want to find us on Instagram, you can go over there. And yeah, that's all I have to say on the podcast updates. But
that was great. That was thorough, well balanced.
I tried. I rehearsed that a few times. So, well, before I move into our topics and our other segments, did you have anything you wanted to add on, like, the future of the podcast and the new format or anything like that?
Yeah. All I want to add is I'm really excited. I think Some guests are probably going to be added in the future. We're working on kind of building the format for that. So if you in chat or want to email us at quillandquerypodcast@gmail.com or talk to us on Instagram and give recommendations on who you would like to see in the indie self-published space potentially be interviewed, that's also something that we are going to work on. So slow and steady. We both have jobs and are working on multiple projects and this. So,
yes,
you know, it's going to take some time, but we're getting there. And I'm just genuinely really excited. I'm so impressed with us that we are now in season two. I'm just patting ourselves on the back.
Yeah, I think we've made a lot of progress since the very first episode. So super proud of us as well. We do not have any audience questions this week, but we do have one missed indie release to spotlight, and that is going to be Games We Play in the Dark by Nicole Johnson. I think, Ash, you found this one, so just correct me if I'm wrong, but that is already out, correct?
It is. It came out earlier this month. I went ahead and chatted with her to make sure. So it was published in July, and you can find it on Barnes & Noble and Amazon.
Awesome. Looks like we have our number one viewer, Nicole, in the chat. So I think people can hear us. Nicole, if you notice any problems with that, please let me know. But yeah, this is our first episode using Riverside. So, all right. Well, now that we got all the intro stuff out of the way, we can move into our publishing and book discussion topics for the week. I still got to rename this segment, but... I was kind of trying to think of things we haven't talked about before. So one I wanted to start with was book trailers, which doesn't seem to be a very popular marketing technique, but they definitely exist because I've seen some. So I wanted to get your thoughts on, I guess, mostly from a consumer perspective, but then also, as always, I like to get both perspectives, like from the consumer side and then from the creator side. But what are your thoughts on book trailers? Like, do you ever see one that really makes you go, "Oh, I have to read that," or I don't know. Do they feel effective to you?
That's a really hard question to answer, only because I know like most people who are doing book trailers are doing this on their own, you know, most of the time. And I'm gonna throw out a decent guess to say most of them are not like video editors or, you know, have the money obviously to spend on like high quality footage or whatever. So I am kind of torn because if it's a bunch of like Pinterest photos, kind of like in a real setting, I'm less interested only because I have the same photos probably saved on my Pinterest. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But a lot of people put in a lot of hard work, so I'm not going to nix him. It does not guide me either way, whether or not I'm going to buy a book. Usually the aesthetic of something always sticks out to me, so it can be a really good way to relay the aesthetic of a book. But in terms of whether or not you're going to hook me with it, that usually isn't necessarily the case. I really like blurbs. I like seeing like an actual, like some text with it. If it is going to be a video of text, you know, they're different ways to do that, but I would like to see the style of writing usually before I'm like fully committed to the book via that type of format. While acknowledging it's really hard work, I don't think it's something I will personally do in my endeavors, only because I'm just like too much of a perfectionist and I feel like I would edit that thing to death and then I'd just be miserable about it. But mad props to anyone who does do it. It takes a lot of work and a lot of staring at your phone.
Definitely.
But yeah, what about you? Are you like a book reels kind of guy?
So when I say book trailers, I think there's like two camps of trailers that I'm thinking of. There's like the TikTok/reels style where it's kind of like a lot of times, like you said, it's a lot of just photos. It's more like a slideshow. And then here's the book. Those, I think I'm a little more, I care a little less. Like I don't feel one way or the other about them really. Cause I understand they're an effective marketing, at least seemingly so, tool on TikTok and Instagram, especially for like people in the self-published and indie space. Another type of trailer is more something I think it's more common for like traditionally published books, but it's like an actual trailer, like
Yeah.
Like you might see it on TV or before you watch a YouTube video. And even those are kind of weird in the sense that they're just using like a stock video and then there's some text and then it here's the book.
Right.
I think those ones I feel more strongly about. Like, I feel like they're kind of a waste of the marketing budget, at least from the consumer's perspective, because I've never seen one of those and been like, oh, I really got to buy that book. I think when it comes to books, the thing that wins me over the most is like the blurb or the text, like you said, just because that's more indicative of the experience you're going to get. A trailer works for something that's more of a visual medium, in my opinion, like a movie or a video game or something along those lines where the visuals are an important part of that experience.
Right.
But I feel like there's not really a need for like a visual, that strongly visual of a marketing tool for books, in my opinion, anyway. Like, I think if you go to like official artwork or something along those lines, that'll win me over more likely than
agreed
generic stock photo or video or whatever. But I don't think I've ever been swayed by a book trailer. Now, maybe subconsciously I have, I don't know. I know that's how some of these marketing things work, is you don't think they work, but they really do. But no, I've just never really been impressed particularly by a book trailer.
Yeah, I think that is where I understand the desire to mess around with it, to give it a shot and to see where it can lead you. But yeah, I think there have been times where I've seen the artwork that's meant for the book then turned into kind of like a moving picture kind of reel thing.
Yeah.
Which is cool. I really enjoy that. But as you mentioned, I think trailers are for like maybe reveals, like title reveal when you've got like moving pieces and you're, you know, whatever. But in terms of just like selling your book, if it's a comic book, I think that works really well, again, because you can kind of manipulate bits and pieces. But yeah, for like a traditional book, it's just not something that I am drawn to. But I know some people are like really into them and, you know, find that to be lucrative. So I guess it is just, you know, whatever you choose. But yeah, I'm not the biggest fan.
Yeah. Well, I think like a lot of things, we're kind of in the same camp there.
We need to get someone we like really disagree with on here just to have a little bit of...
Yeah, for real. We'll just pay someone to say like controversial things or something.
Right.
Okay, we'll move on to our next topic here. Sure. I wanted to talk a little bit about book pre-orders. We have a comment from Nicole. She likes them, but not all. I think she's talking about the book trailers. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Some are, I feel like, kind of well done, and but for the most part, it's I'm in the camp of just show me the cover and the blurb.
Yeah. I'm a bit indifferent, I guess. I think that's my best word for it.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
Next up, we've got book pre-orders. So, one, I wanted to know, do you ever pre-order books? And why or why not? Like, what is the determining factor for you, whether you will pre-order or not?
Okay. I will pre-order books. We'll only pre-order books if it is from an author that I have previously really enjoyed and it's a new series or it's a continuation of a series that I love. That's really the only reason. Again, I'm on like a self-inflicted book buying kind of ban. I'm really trying to utilize my library more. Recently, the only one I've gotten pre-order that has come in was Danielle Jensen's A Fate Inked in Blood. I got that one a few months ago. It's been a minute. I have to really already enjoy the author. Even this probably sounds really pretentious and mean, and I don't mean it that way, but if it's a fellow indie author and I know them really well, like for you or for like anyone in our anthology, I will pre-order things. But that's also sometimes a gamble if you don't know the person really well or you don't know their writing style. But if it's just like somebody on TikTok that I follow or on Instagram, I will probably wait to buy it until it's out or I've seen a little bit more content, only because I'm just trying to be more frugal about bookshelf space and where my money is going. Right. Mama's on a budget, so I tend to wait. I think pre-orders are important, especially in the indie self-published space. Mm-hmm. A lot of people rely on them to see, you know, how much they need to order and the interest that they have drummed up. So it's always good to pre-order if you are a fan of somebody. I think I just have self-imposed limitations on myself that make me not as quick to pre-order.
Yeah. Yeah, those make sense. I think I'm pretty closely aligned. I haven't ordered or pre-ordered a book in probably a hot minute, but yeah. I kind of had the same restrictions as far as it has to be an author that I know that I'm going to enjoy or have mm-hmm. enjoyed in the past. Whether it's existing or a new series, I don't really care at that point, as long as yeah. I think I'm more banking on the author's writing skill. Mm-hmm. And I know that their work is, I'm going to buy it anyway, so I don't really mind. There are some things that I haven't had to like keep myself from pre-ordering, but I've noticed, I think it was in the Fourth Wing series. I don't remember what the overarching series is called, but mm-hmm. where pre-orders opened for like book three, like almost right after book two came out or something, like yeah. I'm like before a title or a cover mm-hmm. was even out. And even if like George R. R. Martin came out and said, you guys can pre-order The Winds of Winter right now, I would probably still wouldn't until there was like a solid release yeah. date and cover and, you know, title.
Yeah, totally.
I think it's weird to sell a product that doesn't even exist yet. Like a pre-order yeah. is for, okay, this product exists and this is when it's going to ship, so you can buy it now and then you don't have to remember when the time comes.
Yes. But
buying like the promise of a product is really weird to me.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, even for faves, like if they say like release date of like 2024, if I like have a gauge, I'll usually be like, okay, yeah, sure, totally. Hi, it's good to see you in our chat. People in the chat, it's always
exciting. Hi, Mina. I think I read your name right. Sorry, my phone's like over here, so I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing yeah, anyone's name wrong.
We're adjusting new too, so. Yeah, pre-orders are interesting. I know they're essential for like the indie authors, like the self-published for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to be a little bit kinder. I don't know. I'm also like, you know, it's like $11 here or $15 here and it does add up. So
right.
I usually have to be swayed. And Kindle Unlimited does that too, you know, where you're like a few of the authors that we know are on Kindle Unlimited. So mm-hmm. sometimes that's nice because I'm already paying for the service and I'll download. And then if I really enjoy it, I'll actually go buy it either digitally or physically. But yeah.
Yeah.
Some limitations for sure.
Yeah, I forgot to even mention the indie book space, but I'm same camp. Like if it's someone that I know pretty well through like most of the authors in our anthology group, I buy their books.
Yeah.
The only ones that I haven't bought are because I'm behind in some of the series right now.
But, yeah.
Yeah, just kind of the same thing. Like I have to know either the person or the author to some extent, right? Mm-hmm. To put up a pre-order. But
yeah, some people are not that way though. Some people are just like, I like the premise, insta buy, and I envy those people sometimes. I think too, you know, I don't know. I'm just a little too picky.
Yeah. Well, I'm also getting like limited shelf space over here, so I got to be picky yes. about what I put on my shelf before I buy a new shelf.
Yeah, right. I'm like, I have whittled down my bookshelves to things that I really love. And so anytime I'm going to add something to my bookshelf, at least right now with my limited space, until we build more bookshelves, it's like it's got to be reserved for the best, you know, things that right. I really, really just love. So anyway, no shame to people who just buy everything.
Yeah. Well, on to people who don't buy anything. Let's talk a little bit about book piracy. This has
what a
been
good segue. That was an excellent segue. That was really good.
I know you fed it like right to me, so I had to take it.
I didn't even mean to.
But yeah, book piracy. Part of my problem is probably I'm on Threads too much, which is starting to feel too much like Twitter, where it's a lot of engagement bait and just saying something controversial to get mm-hmm. clicks and likes and comments and whatnot. But it's also a good place for me to find topics for this, so I probably won't stop. But yeah,
I get it.
I've seen a few threads on there talking about book piracy and what constitutes like to these commenters ethical piracy, or what considerations they make for like what books they're going to buy and mm-hmm. what books they're just going to find on find in the seven seas, I guess. I don't know how to say this without getting like banned on TikTok for using the wrong words, but I mean, I'm very like strongly in one camp here, but I want to know your thoughts. Like, do you think it's ever okay to before TikTok, mm-hmm. we're not endorsing piracy in any way. We're just discussing a topic from Threads. Okay. I want to make that distinction, but can you understand where some of these people are coming from? Are you kind of like me where you're in the hardline camp of like, I just don't ever see piracy as ethical or okay?
Yeah. No, I'm right there with you. I kind of feel like as I've gotten older, that old commercial that used to play when you got your DVDs, that's like right. piracy, you know, like there needs to be that in front of a book too, you know? Also, I think that just like showed our age a bit, but yeah, I don't, I just don't think there is any acceptable reason to do that at like period. Right. There are truly so many options for you to be able to read a book. You don't even need to buy it. You like truly like libraries. I will just always right. like, that's my first go-to. One of my very first, like, it wasn't even viral, but like one of my bigger liked videos for a really long time was me responding to another creator on TikTok who her premise was, if I buy a book from like a Barnes & Noble and I read it and then I return it, that is not theft. And technically that's not right, but you are hurting the author because mm-hmm. that the whole monetary component of it is still there.
Right.
And if you didn't like it, then go sell it to a secondhand used bookstore, you know, or don't right. buy it in the first place and literally wait for it to come to your library. There are thrift books online. There are so many options that I just have like zero sympathy for anybody who tries to pirate a book or do anything like that. Exactly, just like Nicole said, libraries. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I have not heard a good reason for that.
Period. Same. I think some of the most common reasons I see are, one that I kind of want to push back on is the affordability aspect. Mm-hmm. Books are probably the cheapest form of entertainment you can buy.
Yep.
Compared to like film or video games. Mm-hmm. Especially if you buy ebooks, I rarely see an ebook that's more than $10. And at the risk of saying something controversial, if $10 for a single book is too much, maybe there are other priorities. Now, like, also, I want to put out there as an indie author who's going to publish one day, if you are in that much of like a serious financial hardship, and a book will help you, I would honestly rather you just reach out to me and be like, I can't buy your book, but could you give me a copy? Like, I would honestly be fine with that if you could just show me that you're genuine. Mm-hmm. Nicole says, I will say books are expensive and I get it, but I don't think ebooks should be 30. To that point, mm-hmm. if an ebook was $30, that's more than like a paperback in most places. So yeah, that'd be a little weird. I wouldn't justify that price point either. Or if I get the physical, I get the ebook with it, or like a PDF. Another argument I see is like, if you disagree with the author from like a moral perspective. So an author that comes up here is J.K. Rowling, mm-hmm. and totally fine if you like object to an author's personal views, but in my opinion, that's kind of a false equivalence. Like saying it's okay to pirate because you disagree with someone, I feel like you're sending the wrong message. Like, it would be better, in my opinion, to not engage with their content.
Like, literally, why are you engaging with it if you don't like them morally? Right. Like, right? So like, why would you need to pirate it in the first place? It's like, if you want to read their book but you object morally, then like, you don't get to read the book, right? And if you don't object that much, then pay for it. Because it's not just like, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I feel that way very deeply about art too. Like, mm-hmm. if you are going to pay for art, or if, like, you're going to a museum, right? Like, you're looking at art, and the artist whose art is on the wall is objectively, like, a horrible person. I mean, what you're still looking at is, like, art, right? Like,
yeah.
You're gaining something from it, even if it is a conversation around their atrocities or what they were and who they were as a person and how they, you know, influenced the society they were in, whatever. There's just, mm-hmm. like, so much more context around it than just, like, objecting, right?
Yeah.
And when it comes to, like, the physical books that you're pirating, it's not just all, like, all of it's not going right into the author's pocket. You have the editors, you have the agents, you have the people who make the books, you have mm-hmm. all these different components of that price, while I agree, like, is going up and can be a barrier for people. Okay, well then, like, again, request it at your local yeah. library, or go on ThriftBooks, or reach out to the author. I know so many authors on here who will actively just, like, give you their book.
Right.
Like, they're just like, do you want it? our shout out today for our indie book release, she was like, do you want my book? And I was like, nope, it's in my cart. Like, I'm going to buy it because I can, and I want yeah. to support my fellow authors. But, like, so many are just willing to send for nothing, you know?
Right.
So yeah, truly no excuse. And if yeah. I find out anybody pirates that follows me, it's just blocked. It's blocked immediately.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely in the same camp. Also, to the, like, reading the whole book and then returning it thing, I think that is also a little disingenuous as well. It's kind of like you can't go to a movie and then request your money back at the counter when it's over. Like, that's just not how it works.
Or you eat your appetizer and you're like, it was really gross, but the plate is empty. You're like, no, yeah. no, that doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's ultimately, it's not like you're not buying a guarantee that you're going to like something. And I think some people have a problem with that. But I'm perfectly fine. I've paid money for books that I knew I wasn't going to like, but I wanted to read them anyway. Mm-hmm. Because one of the best pieces of advice I got was, like, make sure you're reading bad books as well, or books that you don't enjoy. Yeah. Just so you can see, like, this is how maybe you don't do these things when you're writing.
Totally.
And totally. So I still think those books are worth the money I paid for them. I might not enjoy them, but mm-hmm.
Lessons learned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously. I mean, that's true. And that's the thing, is, like, you need to be reading outside of your genre. You need to be reading authors that you might not like, but try them out. Yeah. There's, like, well, tons of reasons that you should buy books, even if, you know, they end up being not ones that you really enjoy. But yeah. Again, libraries, you just don't like it, you return it. And that's great. And no
yes.
one gets hurt.
Libraries are great. Support your local libraries.
Yes, right. They're under attack more than ever. So.
Unfortunately.
I know.
All right. Well, let's move into our writing topics for the week. We have a few fun ones to go over. But before we get into that, we like to do, as most of you know, our weekly work in progress check-in. So, Ash, how are your writing ventures going?
Slow but steady. I am a third of the way through chapter 9 for Filthy Hunger, and I am replotting some stuff for the anthology short story. I've taken a break from the anthology short story only because I continue to be frustrated by it. Not because of anything to do with anybody else, but just because short stories are hard, and I am not right. used to short stories, and it is a challenge, one that I welcome, but had to kind of just, like, shift to the actual book for a while to mm-hmm. kind of loosen up the squeaky wheels. So, yeah, some really good progress. So I'm happy about it. What about you?
Very cool. I don't really have, like, a word count to share or anything. It was kind of a busy week for me, so I didn't get a lot of, like, just straight up writing done. What I did do quite a bit of was some plotting and outlining work, not even for book one of A Knight of Knives, but for book two, which has kind of had, like, an empty outline for a while.
Nice.
So what I like to do is, if I'm not being productive as far as, like, writing book one goes or writing the mm-hmm. anthology goes, I like to still make some progress on something. So book two's outline has been something that I've kind of had the broad strokes of defined for a while, but as far as, like, the specifics and maybe, like, the chapter breakdowns, and especially when it comes to the ending, that has kind of been a struggle for me up until recently. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had, like, a really good plotting session where I got a lot of book two's outline done.
Nice. Oh, that's amazing.
And I really like how it lines up with what I've written so far for book one and how that outline goes. So I'm sure it'll change, obviously, like these things do. But I'm just happy to kind of have like that. Now, not only do I know where book one is ending, but I can see where the whole series is going to end because I planned for two books. So,
right.
Just having
that's awesome.
Yeah, having that overarching vision is really nice to kind of be able to see where things should hopefully line up in the end.
Yeah, I need to really hunker down and get some. I've got like chunks and gaps in A Filthy Hunger where I'm like, okay, I know like the major like columns of what needs to happen, but then the in-between spaces of like how they get there is still kind of like up in the air for most parts. And I was writing today and I was just kind of like, oh, there's a plot hole. Okay, like need to come back to this later and figure out what to do with that. So it's planning sessions and all that are always really important. So that's great.
Yeah, some of it was like book two felt like it did have some plot holes in the overall structure that I had set up for it, but I kind of was able to take care of most of those as far as
good.
I can, you know, tell right now.
Yeah, we'll take it.
So yeah, pretty happy with the progress I've made over there. But yeah, those are our weekly writing updates. Yeah. the mantra is always going to be slow but steady, I think.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. We've got too much going on.
That's actually a good point to transition from to our first writing topic of the week. I wanted to talk a little bit about writing pace and quality. At the risk of having controversial opinions on it, maybe they're not, but I just feel like they will be. But you know, writing pace is obviously something that differs vastly from one writer to another. And there's not really like, I don't want, before I share any of my opinions, I don't want anyone to think I'm saying there's like a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. Like however much you write is however much you write. It's just lately on, again, Threads and Instagram, I've seen some, let's call them have you seen the meme press X to doubt? It's from a video.
He's like wiping his sweat and he's like, which one to press?
So I've seen some like claims of certain writing speeds that do give me a little bit of pause and make me question one, is this really how fast you're writing? But two, what's the quality like as well? Like, is the quality suffering here? Because if you, for those of you who don't know a small author named Brandon Sanderson, I think he's widely regarded in the fantasy genre specifically as being very prolific as far as like his writing speed goes and his output. He puts books out comparatively to other fantasy authors on a very tight schedule, like multiple books a year sometimes. And when I've looked from what I could see, again, this might be wrong, but his word count tops out at like 8,000 to 10,000 a week. This may be old news. He may be writing more than that. I really don't know. I don't want to make any claims for his writing speed because I know the man writes insanely fast, but what made me question, or what made me look that up, is I've seen certain authors on Threads be like, I wrote 30,000 words this week and I meant to write 50,000. And the only reason it gives me pause is because these are usually people who are in the indie publishing space, don't have a lot of books or experience under their belt. Full disclosure, I don't as well, but I'm also not claiming those writing paces by any means. So when I look to the industry and I'm trying to see like, okay, who's the most prolific writer I can think of? Who's the fastest? And it's Brandon Sanderson, and he's a full-time writer. And he's writing around 8,000 to 10,000 words a week. If you are making the claim that you're writing like 4 to 5 times this much, you have to be honest, I feel like, about what that does, what that calls into question as far as your quality of writing is. Because to me, I find it very hard. I'm not saying you can't do it, by the way, to anyone who does that. I'm just saying it casts a lot of doubt and question marks my way to like, okay, but you wrote 30,000 words in however many days. How good is, like, how proud are you of that writing? Like, were you really just trying to get the words down? Is this something where you're going to have to like rewrite 20,000 of those words. So I don't know. There's a lot of questions I have for people who have these really insanely high writing paces and whether that affects the quality of their writing. I just want to say, like, from a potential reader's perspective, it gives me a lot of doubt, if that makes sense. And I don't want that to be taken like as shade or anything, because I'm not saying you can't do it. My question is, how do you maintain the quality while also supposedly writing at such insanely high like outputs that even top people in the industry wouldn't even come near to? So I guess, sorry for my long-winded rant there.
No, but, please.
Yeah, I said that might be a little controversial, but I wanted to get your thoughts on things like, because I know you and I are both in the slow and steady camp, so I also don't want it to feel like I'm saying anyone that writes faster than me is writing too fast, because that is not what I'm trying to say by any means. It's more just like, do you guys feel like that? And Ash, you, from like a reader's perspective, does that make you question the potential quality of something as well? If it's like, I wrote this book in 2 weeks, or, you know, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so I agree with you. Not surprising, because unfortunately you and I are aligned in a lot of things. A couple of notes, I will say, for people like Brandy Sando, they do that for a living, right? Like that is, they are able to carve out time in between coaching meetings and speaking gigs and all these things. Like that is their career, that's what they do. So they are able to bust out 8,000 to 10,000 words a week because that is all they do, right? So for those of us who are balancing family, fun time, work, all of these things, to me, that is more important to find a balance. Like the books will get written. Some people, however, I do think use that almost as like clout. Like I write all of these books or all of these words. And then use that for fodder for content, which is a smart move, because then people are like, oh my gosh. It's like when you see a travel photo for somebody and you're like, oh God, it looked so beautiful. Like, why am I not there? Like, why can't I look that cool? It feels sometimes like a mirage. Like,
yeah,
look here, but really, you know, we've got some other stuff going on. So I'm always impressed, but I don't really believe them sometimes because the quality. Now, okay, some people will write 50,000 words a week and then most of it gets culled in editing, right? Like they do all of that. However, and I'm not ever going to shout anyone out. I have seen authors who on here who put out books very quickly and then I go to read them and I'm like, this could have used 7 more editing revisions. There are mistakes, there are, or it's just not well written, and again, that's always subjective,
right?
But we have discussed on here before, sometimes there is like an objectively, this is a bad book, like this is just not well written, it's not, you know,
right?
So I feel very much that when I see someone who's like, oh, I've written a book in a couple months, I have so many questions. I'm like, are you also working full-time? And it looks like you also have a family. So, like, I'm genuinely curious and I would love to know what the process is for you.
Right.
Because maybe that'll be helpful for somebody. Like, this is how I balance. Our pirate captain does that very well. You know, he's very honest about his work process and, you know, how he balances things out. But, yeah, I think sometimes it is just, like, a bit of a show. And I do wonder how much of that is authentically true. And I do feel like the faster you write, in my opinion, if you are a newer author, the faster you write, sometimes that's not necessarily the best way. Yeah, just like, also, is it Mina or Mina? I'm so sorry. I would love to know how to pronounce your name. I feel so bad, but it's hard sometimes. But she says, I've been super intentional about what I'm writing. So maybe I'm just a slower writer and she is writing slow right now and she's struggling with it. And I want you to know that, yeah, you're completely in the right group of people because
yes,
Mina. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yes, because that's so true. I just feel like intentional writing makes a better book. And that might sound pretentious to me, but if you're spending time and you're not letting like the expectation of what you should be writing get in the way. Sometimes your book, just like I've been working on A Filthy Hunger for years at this point, yeah. but it's taking its time because I am taking my time. And I'm also enjoying life outside of the book writing process. So that was also a long-winded reply to you, but I feel very much the same. I'm always slightly suspicious. I always like seeing people's setups and how they write and how much they're writing, just to get a gauge of like tips and tricks for how I can improve. But yeah, usually the quality lacks if they're blowing through books.
Yeah,
you know, too.
No, agreed.
Yeah,
we have intentional writing. My favorite from Megan Musgrove.
Yes.
Yeah, Megan. I have not read Wingbreaker yet, but I just wanted to say, like, just from her videos and how she kind of shared her writing journey in writing that book, it felt very intentional, and it felt very mm-hmm. like, you know, the book is going to take as much time as it needs. And so I was really excited to see when it did come out. I still have not gotten to it yet, but yeah, I agree that I'm very much in the camp of Ash here with the intentional writing, and Nicole, I would rather wait for a good book than get a subpar book faster.
Yeah.
I think I've kind of settled into the being okay with, I'm probably just going to be, even if I'm self-publishing, in the camp of still taking like trad publishing timelines. Which could be, you know, 2 to 3 years between books sometimes. And I'm totally fine with that, because I think that's the time that I need to write books that I'm proud of. And I really cannot imagine like a worse feeling for me as a writer than putting out a book and then really hating it after the fact, because I felt like I rushed it to meet like mm-hmm. market expectations or something along those lines.
Yeah.
So,
I fully agree. And now some people though, they write shorter novels, and mm-hmm. it's like a complete novel. There's no, you know, there's no second or third novel. So a lot of people I have seen do kind of like the formulaic love interest. I know the hockey romances kind of took off, and a lot of people just kind of like took some of their favorite shows and like reworked them and put them into whatever, or they wrote fan fiction and then they just like took their fan fiction and made them into a different book, and that's okay, but I'd rather there be transparency there, which there tends to be like very little sometimes,
right?
And I just feel like it makes everyone else feel bad because they're like, oh, I'm not succeeding fast enough, but it's like no, like there's a downside to this too. Yeah, and Megan, that's such a good point about drafting clean. I think that's where I work, where I'm like, I want my first draft to be, obviously changes are going to be made, but I want my first draft to be like the best that I can actually produce. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give something either to the publisher or send it to an editor for self-publishing. And it just have to be like 4 more months full of editing because I just blew through it. So anyway,
I'm in the same camp with the clean drafts. I can't, I really try sometimes to get myself into the just get words down mindset, it doesn't work for me. I really feel like when I'm writing, like every word, every sentence is intentional, even in the first draft. And that's just kind of what works best for me, even if it is slow. So I've just kind of embraced that part of my process. It sounds like, Megan, you are not a plotter, you're a pantser, right? Pantser. Is that what I'm getting from your from your comment? I'm kind of a little bit of both. I'm like right in the middle.
Plancer, I think that's what they're called. Plancer.
Is that the
a bit of both?
Correct
I don't know. I heard someone say it the other day and I was like, yeah, I like that. Plancer. I'm a plancer. There's a bit of both.
Mina also says she just posted a video about how slow she's writing her first draft. So thanks for the encouragement. Yes, absolutely. You will always be in the slow and steady camp over here at Quill and Query. So
that's
don't ever feel bad, because I'm probably writing slower than you are. So
same.
You're doing better than someone.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, take the time. I think that's the most important thing. Take your time. There truly is no rush, unless you have a publisher and they're like, the deadline is coming up, and you're like, oh shit, I haven't written anything. Well, then yeah, you should just bust it out. But no one's holding anything over our heads, so we should just take our time.
Absolutely.
Checkpoints. All right. Oh, interesting. Megan said, I use checkpoints. I tend to know where it's going next, but maybe not how. I was just saying that I do the same thing. Checkpoints is a good phrase. I think I might use that in the future.
This, I feel like that's kind of a good way. Maybe not that to that level of pantsing, but kind of close is how my outlines are. Like, I make a list of like the major beats of things, but as far as like the specifics of why and how and what a character like does to get to a certain point, I like to leave room for a little bit of discovery, because I echo Martin in his saying that if he knows like everything about the story before he writes it, he loses all interest in writing it. And I'm kind of the same way.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great little bit of advice. It's just like, you want to explore just like your characters are trying to figure it out too. It's like, put yourself in their shoes. And yeah, that's half the fun, honestly. It's just like writing and getting into the middle of the paragraph and being like, there's an idea.
Yeah.
Get to add it to it later. So yeah, totally.
All right, well, let's move on to our next writing topic here. We've got starting and ending scenes. I went back and forth between this and another topic. I should have put it in like a topic graveyard, but I went with this one because I know everyone kind of likes to approach writing scenes differently. And I have a very, I guess I have very like defined rules for where I start and end scenes. And so I was kind of curious to hear from you. Do you have any like... any tips or any rules that you follow for yourself when you're writing a scene, like as far as where it starts, where it ends, whether it's a scene that's even worth including, or if it's something you mentioned, like, oh, this happened, you know, just what, how do you approach that?
Yeah. So I kind of with like the planter thing, I'm a gut check kind of girl. So if it's got to feel right in the gut. I know I've mentioned this before, but I tend to try and open a scene. Let's say like it's the beginning of a chapter usually. I'm either in the middle of something happening that plays off of where the last chapter ended. So the characters are doing something. We are in the middle of an action. Or I start off with like a line of dialogue, right? Kind of like a hook to draw in the next chapter. Because my book is two points of view, it's a little trickier because timelines up until they meet in the book kind of shift back and forth. Like for Voltaire, it'll be 3 weeks ahead, but we're still back like 3 weeks with Kara. But it doesn't really matter. Like it doesn't matter until they get together that they're on the same timeline, you know? But because there are chapters in between their previous chapters, I have to make sure I'm pulling in from the ending of that last chapter. So yeah, it tends to be something with action that references what has just occurred in their previous chapter. Or I start with dialogue to kind of keep things moving. But I'm always going to try and reference what has just occurred or piggyback off of what has just occurred. So like in chapter 7, the scene or the chapter with Voltaire ends. He's sitting in an office and some big news has been revealed. And then in his next chapter, he's telling his friend what happened in the previous chapter, but kind of surface level. So I don't know if this is making any sense. I try to make sure there's consistency in with what the timeline is giving, right? I'm not just like throwing out a frivolous dance, like they're at a dance or they're at a ball all of a sudden. Like there's got to be continuation and consistency in between what we've left off on and what, you know, what's going to continue in that chapter. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I get what you're saying. Also, thank you, Megan, for, I think all those likes are from you, so thank you so much. Your finger might be sore from tapping the screen so much, so don't feel like you have to do that, but it's appreciated. Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I think the three biggest considerations for me when I'm starting or when I'm writing a scene is, one, like you said, sequentially, it has to make sense. It has to not cause confusion as far as like the order of events and how things are happening. Some of the rules that I've liked that I feel like have worked really well for me in writing scenes is the advice to, I can't remember who these tips come from originally, because I hear them echoed by so many different authors. So sorry that I can't accredit properly, but the first one is to start the scene as late as possible and then end the scene as early as possible. And that doesn't mean like I feel like some people misinterpret that, but what it basically means is you don't need to show, like, if your character is going from point A to point B, you don't necessarily need to always show they walked from this side of town to this side of town. Like, you can start a little later than that. And things like that, like, make sure you're intentional about what's being shown on the page. Try to start at an interesting point and end at a point where, like, it's almost not enough. Not in a good way, though, like, where the reader wants to know more. Like, don't answer, I guess, all the questions. Just end a little earlier than you would maybe initially be inclined to. And that's worked really well for me. Now, I don't know if that you can apply that advice, like, in a multitude of different ways. So that's why I like it as well, because it's not super specific. And it's just really helped me when it comes to structuring a scene, and making sure I cut out those filler moments that might not be necessary.
Yeah, that's a much better and more succinct and clear way of saying it, because that's kind of what I was trying to say, but that's so much more eloquent. I guess my don'ts is I try not to start the chapter or a scene with a block of text. Like, we need some type of movement. Either the characters need to be moving or a conversation needs to be moving forward. Like, everything needs to be moving, which sounds super vague, but, like, I don't need a three-paragraph long description of the room at the beginning of a scene, right?
Yeah.
Have us enter the room first and give a brief description, and, well, why are we there? Like, and in terms of endings, I always try and, like, mini cliffhanger a lot of scenes, especially like chapter ends. I keep referencing chapter end because, you know, that's just usually where I find my biggest punch. But in terms of like endings, you want something that's going to be like, ooh, oh my gosh, okay, what's going to happen next chapter? And then, yeah, you move forward. I think for me, it's a bit easier only because I have alternating chapters. So I give a little cliffhanger for Baltair and then Kara is next, so you have to wait a whole chapter to see then what happens with him. So it's a little bit more of an easier process for me in that regard. In medias res, says Megan.
Oh yeah, I think that's
there we go.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
But yeah, I don't think it's not very, for new authors like us, I think it's a challenge because you don't want to have too much filler, but you also don't want to just like bombard your reader with an introduction to a scene with just like a bunch of talking at, you know,
right.
I just don't want that. So I try not to do that in mine.
I think one of the ways that I've been able to avoid that is I add a lot of my description of like the environment and things like that later. That is one of the few things that I can like tell myself, don't do that just yet. Just because I find that if I start writing the descriptions while also trying to focus on like the dialogue and the internal thoughts of the character, one of those three is going to overshadow the others. And usually it's the description. So I like, if I'm writing a dialogue heavy scene, a lot of times I'll just start with the dialogue and kind of the actions of the characters as they're speaking. And then I'll work the descriptions into that. Like say they're walking through an environment, I'll describe it as it would like come to the speaker or whatever. I find that doing description that way helps me.
That's a good trick.
Significantly, because then I can kind of structure the scene and imagine it first and then write it down, if that makes sense.
Interesting. It does make sense. I work in like the complete opposite. I have to write as it happens. So
yeah,
I have to write the description or else I feel like I don't feel grounded in the story. And so I have done that trick where you just kind of write the dialogue first and then work it out. But for some reason for me, I need to like, I'm like there. So it's almost like a movie is happening. You know, and I'm like, okay, well, like, what's the air feel like? What's smell, taste, touch, texture, whatever? Because so many of my biggest criticisms for a lot of books recently has been like, there's just like a lack of grounding in place. And to me, that's just so important. So, yeah, I have to like kind of go in order of like, he says something, but what is he doing while he's saying something?
Yeah.
And I like can't move on until I've said that. So it is interesting how everyone like does like gets to the end of a scene. It's like different ways of doing the puzzle. It's really cool.
That's interesting. We all have like different approaches to kind of the same puzzle, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, as long as we all get there, you know what I mean?
Yeah. All right. Well, I thought I have exhausted all the possible character related topics, but no, I came up with a really good one today.
You did. So
we talked about protagonists, we talked about antagonists, we talked about supporting characters. I want to talk about I gotta be careful what words I use here because we're also on TikTok. Character deaths. Sure. Not everyone gets a happy ending, and I think both of us write what we'd consider dark fantasy, so I imagine mm-hmm. we're dealing with a good number of tragic endings for some people here. Mm-hmm. So let's, as always, we like to talk about from the reader's perspective and then the writer's. So mm-hmm. one, as a reader, how do you like to see these things handled when a character has to say farewell? And then how does that influence your writing?
I love a good character death. I don't think character deaths, unless you're G.R.R. Martin, happen enough. I think one of the most shocking things for me when I read growing up, like, I'm going to take a couple examples. In Hunger Games, when, and again, spoilers ahead if you haven't read it or are interested in reading it, but it's been a while, so I'm just going to, like, not worry about it. But when, is it Rue or Katniss's sister dies tragically, right? And all of those other characters die tragically. It was such a shock because you're really rooting for them and you want them to succeed against this like horrible dystopian like hellscape. And so each one had such an important pivotal impact without, in my opinion, overdoing it. I know that sounds very vague, but like it spurred Katniss on, but it wasn't just a frivolous death to make her feel more revengeful. These were things that on top of all the tragic things that had already happened, you know, made her complicated and feel complicated things. The Divergent series as well, the main character dies, you know, and that's just like such a twist that you don't see coming. You get attached to a character and then they are no longer there. So many authors utilize them, I think, very well as ways of being more realistic. People in your life die. They are going to die if they haven't already. You know, like this is just a very normal human thing. What I don't like, and I'm going to use Sarah J. Maas here, no offense, in this example, is that at least in the ACOTAR series, nobody dies. Like everyone gets to the brink of death.
Mm-hmm.
And then some miraculously saved. So when their injuries happen and this like potential loss is there, it loses all brevity, right? It just becomes like, okay, like raised back to life. So what happens loses its potency. So for me as a reader, I like when it's utilized as a way not to further instigate the main character or whatever, but as a way to make things more complicated and realistic. I have a few deaths in mind for sure. No spoilers, but I do have a few and they're hard. Like you get attached to your own characters as you write and to just to end them in certain ways. Of course, it's usually as a device for something, but they matter. You know, you spend so much time creating and building them that to say goodbye sucks, but I think it's really important to have if you're writing certain genres.
Right. Sorry to veer off topic, but if we went offline on TikTok for a second, I had to do a verify that I'm still breathing on the live stream thing. So apologies if we cut out there for a minute. But yeah, Megan and Nicole both brought out great points. They can be so impactful to a story. Mm-hmm. And then Megan points out an example in Priory of the Orange Tree, where it sounds like one of the characters had some unresolved relationship
feelings
before they passed away, which I think sorry, I lost my train of thought, but no, I'm very much with you. I think they don't happen enough. Mm-hmm. But I think it's all about like intent for me. There are plenty of stories where characters don't die that I really enjoy, or there's not that many deaths, I guess. But I feel like it's never set up that way either. Like, it's not, my biggest frustration is when there's like the character always makes it out like just in time, or like they just barely escape the consequences. But it's like it keeps promising you that there's stakes, and then there's really not. I'm not a fan of that. I think that's kind of, it's like a shady way to get the reader like to keep reading, in my opinion.
I totally agree. I think it is absolutely 100% just like a device to maintain people's interest.
Yeah.
And then you feel like you're like climbing up a hill and you never needed to climb up it in the first place, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, like I think for certain genres in particular, like for dark fantasy or just any type of like fantasy with high stakes, it's just like a natural thing that has to occur.
Right.
And if there are no important deaths, if I read a book and there aren't any important, which seems so crazy to say, but like if there aren't any, it feels like, okay, well then things weren't that serious.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like even if they come back to life later, like take Lord of the Rings as a perfect example. Like, mm-hmm. Gandalf dies and we think he is dead. We think he's gone, but then he comes back. So it's like, you don't have to keep them dead. Just make it important and pivotal, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think another thing I don't like when it comes to character deaths is when it feels like it is only there just for the shock value, and it mm-hmm. doesn't really change the story in any way, or doesn't really feel like it had any purpose. I like my deaths in narratives to have some sort of impact, because I feel like in real life when someone passes away, that changes your life going forward.
Exactly.
If they were someone important to you, and so I think media should reflect that if it's going to try and deal with those things honestly. Mm-hmm. Like I said, not every story is designed to do that, and that's fine, but I think if you are going to deal with death, you should treat it with like a certain level of authenticity, I guess, to how it actually impacts the people who knew that person. And so I try to just make sure I'm keeping that in mind when I'm writing mine, because full disclosure, A Knight of Knives, as I've said, is a murder mystery, so there's plenty of deaths there. but so part of the challenge has been like, how do you balance the kind of the sudden nature of like a murder with a like how that impacts people, and kind of still making sure those characters get somewhat satisfying ends. With it, it's weird, right? Because sometimes death happens at the wrong time and things are unresolved, and I don't want to act like, oh, everything's always going to be resolved before a character checks out. But yeah, so there's so many things to consider, but I think you really have to be careful with like with any sensitive topic, just treat it with like a certain level of respect to people who have gone through that, and understand that it's an experience that dramatically changes the people that it affects. Mm-hmm.
You're good. I'm sorry.
No, I was just trying to find the good off ramp there. Sometimes I ramble a little bit.
No, that's totally okay. I fully agree. I think it's, you just have to give also, even though they're the characters you created, you have to give some respect to the characters that you created, because these are characters that people are going to get attached to in some shape or form. And they have been a part of your other character stories for however long they've been. You have spent time with them, your readers are spending time with them. So it's not going to be like, it's not going to be just something you can throw away. And I've seen that happen, unfortunately, in a lot of like recent stuff, you know, like specifically the self-published space, where like deaths are used as the catalyst in many ways of just like, oh, the main character's wife dies, so now he's on a revenge binge or whatever. You know, and you're kind of like, okay, and like, why should I care? Why should I give all of my time and energy and effort? And deaths don't have to be big. They don't have to be self-sacrificing, but yeah, they should be serious, especially from you, the author. Like, you created them. So, you know, give them a good goodbye, even if it's not a good goodbye, because sometimes it's kind of brutal. But,
yeah.
Yeah. Just put respect on the names. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got one more writing topic to go over before we move into our last few segments here. Balancing POV characters. So we both deal with multiple, I know. So we're not just writing from one perspective, but as always, like I said, from the reader perspective and the writer perspective, how do you like to see it handled, like when it comes to balancing how many chapters I guess each character gets, or just how frequently you're seeing them? Do you have any rules for yourself in your writing? Because it sounds like you have two main POVs. Correct me if there's more. But how do you balance it, and how does like your reading experience affect that?
Yeah, so I have two main points of view, and then in each book, the villain of that book gets a chapter every 5 chapters.
Okay.
So it seems kind of weird, but it's like 2 chapters for Kara, 2 chapters for Baltair, and then the bad guy gets a short, like, 1-page chapter kind of a
Got
thing.
It.
I want to add more complexity to my world, and therefore I think it's always interesting to see the villain's perspective and what they're doing. It's also possible that in the future I hate that third chapter, the third point of view, and I can easily axe it. That's like the one thing that I'm like kind of fiddling around with.
Yeah.
As a writer, I love writing dual points of view. It's so fun to kind of switch mindsets and just kind of become something else when I write them. It becomes challenging because I tend to identify with one character more than the other. Which I've noticed with this story, which can make it's easier to write Kara, but I don't identify with her nearly as much as I identify with Baltair, but then his chapters are the hardest to write.
Okay.
So it's kind of weird. I have like this weird emotional thing that I've got going
on. That's interesting.
I think dual points of view are really challenging for those reasons. And also you have to make sure that the timelines, even if they shift, like match up, you have to make sure that surprises and twists and turns that happen with one are given just as much, you know, in the other point of view. It's a lot more to wrangle, but I like the challenge, and I've always enjoyed reading multi points of view novels. Like single points of view, obviously, but my preferred is always like, I want to see what like other people are doing, because I think that's where good conflict gets made, where you get a scene with one character and they say one thing, and then you read about it later from their actual perspective when they're thinking back on it, and they're like, I didn't mean that at all. I don't know. I think it creates really good conflict.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'm a huge fan. I will say as a reader, and again, no offense to your fave, but I think the one downside to too many points of view is that if you have a lot of time and space in between when you see a character again, like with the Arya chapters and like some of the later books with G.R.R. Martin, it's like, I don't see her for like 200 pages. And then I've forgotten what's going on with her. So that is a challenge if you have many to juggle. I feel like the trick to that is to make sure it's like consistently even, like every third chapter, it's somebody else, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm a fan. I think even if you are not writing in dual points of view, if you are having a hard time with a scene, or you're having a hard time getting through something in your book, write from a different perspective. Write, even if it's the dog, even if it's a cat, even if it's somebody in the story, just have a little graveyard and kind of use that as an exercise, because it can really, I don't know, open up your eyes to a different perspective. And I think it can be super helpful. So yeah, that's my rant about dual points of view, multiple points of view.
Yeah, I actually like that last point you just made, because that's something that helped me when I got to kind of a wall with A Knight of Knives, was to add a new perspective. Because it felt like the entire plot was just kind of waiting for Theron to show up sometimes. And I wasn't a fan of, like, I mean, this story takes place in the capital city of the kingdom, and I don't want it to feel like it's all just one guy's journey, right? The stakes and the weight of everything should feel a little bit higher than that. And that's just how real life is. Like, things don't wait to happen for you to show up. So, again, it's just more about like the stories mirroring how things happen in real life. Sometimes something bad happens or important when Theron's not there. So I needed to have someone in that space to, because it's not all, it's also not something I can really handle off page or off screen because it's kind of crucial. So that definitely helps if you're struggling, like, to write a scene or a chapter or get your characters to certain places, try throwing in new POVs because it can really help. I think for me, I try to keep like an even cadence in this first book because I do have two for book one. There's going to be more in book two, probably. It's just with how I'm writing book one, I'm being very selective of who gets a POV first. So I think it's going to stay pretty low, but I still don't want there to be like three chapters in a row for one guy and you don't hear from the other one for too long. Like you said, with George R. R. Martin, I agree. Like sometimes you go a long period of time without seeing a certain character and you can forget, or it can feel like they're kind of just sitting around waiting for something important to happen. So I do like to try to have an even cadence without it feeling like I'm forcing the characters to have something interesting to do just to have a chapter. It's one of those things that you just kind of find the balance for as you work on it. I don't really have any tips beyond what we already said. Just keep working at it and it'll click eventually.
Yeah, it can be a challenge. I think for right now, my biggest challenge is because we don't see them get together. When I say get together, I mean like we don't see them interacting with each other until like almost the middle of the book. That because they're not interacting yet, it's really hard to, they're almost too separated in my head because he's going through something, she's going through something. Obviously they are eventually going to get together, but in the meantime I'm worried like I'm taking it too slow. But that's the thing, is like that can get cut, that can get edited later on. Of course, we've talked about filler and how filler isn't like necessarily the best thing, but if chapters need to be cut, that's fine, just get it all out first. But that can be one of the challenges with dual points of view. If you have two characters that eventually do meet, you know, at a later date, you've kind of created two books into one. Sometimes it feels like, where you're like, their storylines are very different right now, but they're gonna get there. So it's hard. It's not that writing a single point of view is any easier or challenging, or you know, vice versa with the dual points of view, but it is a completely different mindset, I think, that you have to have when you're writing, because you have to consider the other point of view. So
so a follow-up question, I think you might have already answered this, so sorry if I am asking again, but have you written any of the scenes where they are in the same place as of yet, or not?
I've written scenes, just not like the full chapter. I'm not quite there yet in the chapters yet.
Do you ever find that like it's hard to stay in one mind and not let the other one bleed in at all, or not really?
I actually don't. As of right now, I haven't experienced that. I have like my folders full of like different, just like scenes that I'm like, I need to write this because, you know, it's got to get written down somewhere. I actually find it really, really fun because they both have very different opinions about one another. And so it's an easy switch to make when they are interacting with one another. If I'm writing from his perspective, I know exactly what he's thinking about her. And then reverse for that too, because so much of this book is about like breaking down the stereotypes of their kingdoms and their, you know, races and stuff like that. So it's more fun than it is challenging. I don't have, as of right now, talk to me in a couple months, but I currently don't have any struggle with that. In fact, it's like my favorite thing to write, when they're like arguing with one another.
I'm
like, oh yeah, okay, I get to just like talk through him and then reverse with her.
That's interesting. Megan says her favorite thing is having the different voices for different POVs, reading or writing. Yeah, I agree. I think that's something I don't really struggle with, is like creating, at least I don't think I do. Maybe when I share it with people, they'll think differently. So don't take my word for it, but I feel like I'm able to create a unique voice for each character. But I do run into the problem of if they are in a scene together and I'm writing from one perspective, sometimes one bleeds into the other and I have to like go back and fix it and make sure like, no, we're in this person's head today, not the other. But it's weird because when I'm writing separate chapters, I'm very much in that character's head. It's just when they're all in the same scene, sometimes I get a little
that
lost.
Makes sense. Now, so here's my question to you then. So when you do have some struggle with that, is it because the characters are too similar that it's an easy bleed through, or is it just because you're writing like two perspectives and it's just naturally hard?
I don't think it's because they're too similar, because like I said, I think I'm doing okay at creating a unique voice for everybody.
Yeah.
It's more just like it's a hard thing to explain really, but like I'm so used to being in all of their heads that when they're all in the same room, it just, for whatever reason, I have to be very conscious of how I'm writing it. Like,
yeah, that makes sense. Less a lot of risk.
Yeah. It's, because I think it's because I'm trying to be in all of their heads at once.
Sure.
When I should really be mostly in just whoever's perspective it is. So that's probably where it comes from, if I had to guess, because I'm,
that makes complete sense,
just because of how attached I am to each of their internal monologues, I guess, if that makes sense. But
yeah, now that you mention it, you know, there is, I do have to like stop myself every now and then, and I have to be like, this is not something that like Kara would know, right?
Yeah.
It's like those kind of things definitely do bleed through when I write a scene with both of them in it. Because you're just like, oh shit, no, she shouldn't know that yet. Like, but he's talking about it because he knows. Mm-hmm. So it can be really challenging to keep them separated but together. So yeah, I do very much understand what you mean.
All right. Well, I think that covers all our writing topics. So we'll move into our weekly writing resources. Unfortunately, I got a little sidetracked, everybody, and I was too busy fiddling with Riverside, so I did forget to search for a resource. I apologize, but Ash has a lovely resource to share with you, so I'm going to put her on the spot here.
No, that's okay. So it is, mine this week is the Alliance of Independent Authors. So it is essentially a group that has private forums, contract advice, discounts on stuff, guidebooks, literary agent advice, and connections and advocacy and all this kind of stuff. It's essentially like, I am totally blanking on what you would call it, a membership. Like you pay your dues to this membership, and then it's like a union-esque where they can really help you figure out all the legality stuff. It seems like a really good resource for specifically independent authors and self-published authors. Would
Very
highly
nice.
Recommend taking a look at it. I probably won't join until I have an actual book, but for those of you who do, could be a really useful resource to check out. So mine.
Sounds really cool. I'll have to check that out. Well, like I said, I don't have a resource to follow up with, so we'll move into our wrap up here. We do have a few viewers with us on TikTok today, so I'll give them, I can't see everyone's name, so apologies, like I usually can on live studio, but if anyone has any questions, any comments, any suggestions for topics, or maybe suggestions for guests you'd like to see on the show now that we're kind of working towards that. Anything you want to suggest, this is the time to share your feedback and your ideas. So we'll give you guys a few minutes to do that. And then if no one has anything, we'll wrap it up for this week.
Yeah, a little bit early, but that's okay.
Yeah, I noticed that.
That's okay. We're usually like right on time or just a bit early. So that's okay. It's not a big deal. We can have some variation.
Yeah, that's okay. Megan says this was fun. Catch you guys next time. Thank you so much for joining.
Hi,
Megan. And
we'll
for
see you next time.
The many likes you gave us.
Yes, really appreciate it. Hopefully we see you next week. Yeah, we're gonna have to start working on like we're gonna create like a framework for guests to then come on and interview. So exciting.
I was trying to think through how we do that. There's we could set up a Google form, we could just take emails, we could do both. There's so many different approaches, so we'll see what everybody wants. Oh, thank you so much for the rose, Megan.
Thanks, Megan. Oh, what a gem. Yeah, well, if no one has any questions, always hit us up at our Instagram Quill and Query Podcast on Instagram. The inbox is always open. We also have an email, same thing, quillandqueryPodcast@gmail.com. So if you have any questions, comments, concerns, gripes, maybe not gripes, but we'll take it. You know, it's interaction.
Yeah, any message is a good message, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so.
But yeah, thank you guys so much for joining. And Ash, before we sign off, do you have any closing thoughts you want to share with anybody that we didn't already touch on?
Nope. Just congrats to you, Brandon, for making this happen. You were the original creator of all this. And season 2 is a pretty good accomplishment, I'd say. So props to you.
I couldn't have done it without my wonderful co-host. So thank you as well.
Anytime.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining. Thank you, Ash, as always, for being here. And we'll see all you guys next week.
Bye, guys.